don't really like it, but it can be a challenge sometimes to get there. My word of warning to you is not to focus exclusively when you're studying on cardiac. Students are like, oh, cardiac's so hard, I need to study. That's only a third of the test, roughly. You'll have respiratory lecture as well, so that's another 20 questions. You had the musculoskeletal and emergency that was posted. There are, there's not 20 questions on it. Maybe there's 17. Is this the one with the delegation questions? Yeah, I believe there's delegation questions on that as well, or on this exam as well. So kind of like, don't put all your eggs in one basket and realize. Now, when I talk about cardiac, some of them will have different murmurs. I don't go into, in particular, the defects. We talk about the defects. The biggest thing to know when we're talking about cardiac defects is how our blood is flowing. So is it a left to right shunt? So the blood's flowing back to the lungs, which would make it a defect that increases perfusion here. So we're getting oxygen, we're getting plenty of oxygen with a left to right shunt. So oxygen's not the problem with that kind of shunt. So we don't worry about that. We do worry about the blood that is going back over there and what's that gonna do to the lungs. We have to think about that as well. Or is it a right to left shunt? So we're pushing blood away from the lungs. That blood's not picking up oxygen. We used to call it cyanotic defect, and some still might. Terms kind of evolve, and we go around and around and about sometimes. But or is it a cyanotic defect? So we're pushing it away. So we look at that in general. How is the blood flowing? And as a result, what is that going to cause to my patient? So we're going to start out. I do have a PowerPoint just because I find that sometimes it's easier for you to follow along, but I'm covering the information that's in your handout. Okay. Well, I'm going to start recording. And hopefully it has started recording. Okay, it has. So I'm sharing my screen, which is my PowerPoint. So basically when we talk about this information, you have this information on your handout. It's basically telling you what's going on when we're looking at those changes are the changes from gestation to birth. So they can pick up a fetal heart rate about post-conception day 17, which is amazing if you think about it. The four chambers of the heart starts out as a tube. It's not like it is when we're big, but it starts out as a little heart tube. Still beats, the chambers and the arteries and everything forms week 2 to 8. So it takes a while. We know the baby receives oxygen in utero, the fetus receives oxygen in utero from the placenta. So that's just kind of standard. The foramen ovale, these are fetal structures. Foramen ovale is an opening between the atria, and that lets blood go from the right to the left atrium. That blood does not need to pick up the circulatory pathway. It does not need to go to the lungs for oxygenation because the fetus is getting its oxygen from the placenta, from the mom. So we don't have to worry so much about that because we have that placenta that's taking care of that need. the lungs do have a little bit of oxygen, but they're not working like they do in adult circulation for all of us. So the foramen ovale is a shunt. It's present in utero, it's present in the fetus, and it's to shunt that blood away from the lungs. And then there's another shunt, there's a couple of shunts actually. The ductus arteriosus allows blood flow between the pulmonary artery and the aorta. And it again is shunting blood away from the pulmonary circulation because it doesn't function the same in utero. So you've got all that information there. These are the anatomic structures. And I did not give you those, I don't believe. But again, these are the ones we just talked about. They'll close in response to pressure changes. So once that baby's born, that baby takes that first breath is what they determine. We start to see those pressures changing and the baby will revert to adult circulation or regular circulation, whatever you'd like to call it. This is what it looks like. So, and there's this picture in your book as well, and it'll take you through that. So, A, the kind of not so vibrant colored one. This is our fetal circulation. You can see how the blood comes in through the superior vena cava, hits that right atria. Big part of it is shunting over. Okay, so we're going to shunt it over. It's not going to actually work. So this is our foramen ovale. It's shunting it over. You can't really see it. It's back here. But we have blood that's coming back in. It's going to the left atria. It's going out. And then it's able to go on its little merry way. This is our ductus arteriosus. This little teeny thing here is our ductus arteriosus. And it carries some of the blood, instead of sending it out the pulmonary artery, which is what happens here, right atria, right ventricle, out to the pulmonary artery, to the heart, to the lungs, then it comes back and dumps into the left and then out into pulmonary circulation. So what we have here is another little shunt. So instead of sending that blood through the pulmonary artery to the lungs, we're sending it back in to regular circulation, so it's not going to the lungs. Of course, that's different in our circulation. So right atria, right ventricle, out the pulmonary arteries to the lungs. The blood picks up oxygen there, comes back through the pulmonary veins. And then again, we have it's coming back from both of the lungs, left atria, left ventricle, and out and down to supply the oxygen needs. And then it just picks up this path and continues. The ductus venosus, we don't talk very much. We don't talk very much about the ductus venosus. That is working with the liver. And it will also become a ligament at regular circulation. So that, again, it's going to affect... it's going to help blood flow in the fetus, and we don't need it in regular or adult circulation, which is what it's called. So they do change. They do change in response to. Question number one, is the following statement true or false? The nurse records an infant's heart rate as 128 beats per minute. This is a normal infant heart rate, and it will decrease with age. True or false? True. We agree? Baby's hearts beat faster. And I've always told students, you have to tune in your ears because you're coming from big people. So when you transition from taking care of big people predominantly and you start taking care of little people, in particular when you do your OB and everything and you're with those newborns, you have to tune in your ears and get used to listening to a lot faster heartbeat because they are fast. Okay. Normal infant heart rate averages 120 to 130, roughly. Toddlers or preschoolers, 80 to 105. school age, again, 70 to 80, which is kind of normal. And the adolescent would be 60 to 68. Okay, so we're going to talk about the two categories today. We're going to talk about congenital heart disease, and we're going to talk about that first, and that's what the baby is born with. We're also going to talk about acquired heart disease. An acquired heart disease is something that, of course, occurs after birth. So a congenital heart disease, these are structural anomalies that are present at birth. And then again, when we say CHD or congenital heart disease, that's the largest percentage of all birth defects. So again, kind of interesting if you think about it. Acquired, of course, occurs after birth. There's a lot of causes, and there's a lot of different things that can cause the acquired heart disease. And it can occur as a complication, or it can be a long-term effect of an initial CHD. So they have that congenital heart disease to begin with. So just a little bit of difference there. The next thing is cardiac catheterization. This is a diagnostic procedure. It's covered in your book. It is a diagnostic procedure. It's the definitive study for cardiovascular disease. I don't know if any of you got to go to a cath lab in second level, may or may not have. Maybe that's an opportunity you'll have in fourth level if you haven't been to a cath lab. But this gives the doctors and everybody information about the saturation in the heart, pressure changes, the output, and any anatomic anomalies or abnormalities that are taking place. What we do with a cardiac cath, we're putting a catheter into the heart through a peripheral vessel. So they're putting this catheter into the heart using a peripheral vessel. We're using fluoroscopy to guide our catheter. And once it's where we want it in the heart, we're going to introduce contrast so we can have pictures, which is a good thing. So we want to be able to see, and that's the best way we can see the actual heart and what's going on. A lot of times in kiddos, and even big people a lot of times too, we'll use the femoral. We'll go through the femoral vessel. We can also do brachial, we can do arm, or we can do leg, but a lot of times we'll do leg just because it's a larger vessel. So we can go in the arm, we can go in the groin, so we can see this. It's threaded through, it's in the heart, and then once it's there, it can take pictures and go through, see the valves and everything else, which is really, really cool, right? You think about it, it's kind of nifty that we're able to do that. But the downside to this is, what about our complications? What problems can arise as a result? Can you think of any? What can happen as a result of sticking a catheter through a vessel and threading it through to the heart? What can happen? Damage to the vessel. Good one. What else? Infection. Okay. We're introducing something from outside inside. Good. What else? Have issues with the dye. That's a very good one. Bleeding. Hemorrhage can be a problem, right? Okay. So dysrhythmias, we can kind of knock that heart out of regular rhythm. So we can have dysrhythmias. Hemorrhage. Talked about that. They can bleed. Vascular damage or perforation. So we can have damage to the vessel. We're putting a catheter through, so we can damage it. Some instances they can perforate it. Okay, so we have to think about that. Vasospasm of the catheterized vessel. How about loss of pulse in the extremity? Sometimes don't think about that one, but we can. We can lose that pulse in that extremity as a result. thrombus or embolus formation. They can throw a clot, form a clot, and they can throw a clot. Neither of which are good things. Infection, I mentioned that one as well. Reaction to the dye. And that was one of the students up here said, reaction to the dye. It's very important. It can be mild. It can go from vomiting, which doesn't feel mild at the time, but it can be from vomiting. They can go all the way to the other end to anaphylaxis, which we talked about previously. So a lot of things can happen as a result. So now, what do we need to think about post-cath, or how are we going to care for them? They go have their cath, they come back. What are we going to do? So what position would we want them in? How about bed rest? Do we want them getting up and moving around? Yeah. No. We want to keep that extremity straight 4 to 8 hours after a cath. Okay, so think about our position. Keep the extremity straight. I told you they most often go through the groin because that vessel's a little bit larger, perhaps. So they'll go through the groin. Just majority of the caths I've seen, they've gone through the groin. But anyway, they can go through the arm as well. But they go through the groin. So we've got a leg. We're going to keep them on bed rest. We're going to keep that extremity straight for 4 to 8 hours. Now, the one thing you should be thinking in the back of your mind is, okay, this is with a child. Do you see some of the difficulty that might ensue because it's with a child? I've been with adults that have had casts. Let me tell you, there are difficulties that ensue when you tell anybody they have to stay flat with that leg kept straight or whatever it was a leg in this case, but keep that leg straight, and they've got to do it for 4 to 8 hours or 4 hours or whatever. So anytime you tell somebody they've got to keep that leg straight, the first thing they want to do is move it. Because you get tired of keeping it in that one position. So we have to think about that. If we're dealing with an infant can be held in mom or dad's lap. So that sometimes helps. Older children, if we have them in the bed, we're only going to elevate the head of the bed no more than 20 degrees. Okay, so you realize a 20 degrees in much. Okay, we're not going to have all the pillows behind them, because what happens when we put them in that position? Where do we have a bend? If we lift up the head of the bed, where do we have a bend? Right there in the groin. So we're kind of defeating our purpose, and we're going to cause more of a problem, or we can cause a problem by doing that. So 20 degrees. We're going to have to monitor their neurovascular status. So if we're monitoring neurovascular status, what are we going to look at? What? The P's, okay. Pulses, right? Okay, so we're going to be doing that. We're going to look at their temperature. We're going to look at their color. We're going to look at their pulses or assess their pulses. So we're going to monitor those things. Bleeding. They'll have a pressure dressing. Okay. We have a pressure dressing on there. Can they bleed out the side of the pressure dressing sometimes? Yeah. Because we're going to have to watch for that. So if we've got somebody, an older child, they're laying in the bed, we might even have them with some mild sedation to kind of facilitate this, we hope. So we've got them in the bed. We're going to monitor them. We're going to look for bleeding. We're going to make sure we look at that little crack. We'll make sure that they're not bleeding down the side and underneath them. What would we do if they're bleeding? Got a pressure dressing. What am I going to do? Are we going to change a dressing on a pressure dressing? No. We're going to add pressure. We're going to apply pressure. In other words, you're going to hold pressure above, below. You're going to apply pressure where that dressing is. Then what are you going to do? Hit the call bell, notify the physician that we're having bleeding, and let them take care of it. If they want to put another dressing on it or another more bulky dressing, whatever. But if they're bleeding already, we're going to apply pressure to stop, just like you would do anybody else's bleeding. You're going to apply pressure to stop bleeding. So we're going to apply pressure. We're going to hold pressure. And we're going to get them up there and get them to assess, and they're going to make a determination what to do. We do not take dressings off. And if they already have a pressure dressing, applying another pressure dressing on top of it might do something, but I would much rather hold pressure myself and let them come decide whether we need to do more or what they need to do. So look at that. They have that. We're going to monitor their INO. Why are we going to look at their INO? What's important about that? Contrast makes you dehydrate. Very good. It does. Contrast has a diuretic effect that makes you dehydrate or causes dehydration. And we talked about dehydration in another lecture, and that's not a good thing with our kiddos. So we're going to monitor that. They probably will have an IV going. The reason for that is because it helps clear the contrast from their system. They'll be able to resume their diet as tolerated. It really just depends. In that initial 4-hour period, they're probably not going to be awake and wanting a whole lot to eat. So I wouldn't say then. But as they're able, we've got to get out of the effects of having the cath done. If the contrast caused any nausea or anything, any of those issues. So we're just going to kind of play it by ear and make sure that we resume as tolerated or as they're able to eat. We want to protect that site from infection. So even when they go home following a cath, are we going to want them in a bathtub initially? No. So we could put them in a shower. We're going to have to look at that and kind of see what we want to do. And then again, a lot's going to depend upon what they find from the cath or the results of the cath. So let's talk a little bit about congenital heart disease, congenital heart defects, whatever you prefer to call it. I go back and forth. So as I started off saying, we have left to right shunting lesions. Those lesions that increase pulmonary blood flow, they're shunting from the left to the right. These lesions are your ASD, your atrial septal defects, your VSDs, you have ventricular septal defects. So basically you have a smaller hole or a larger hole between the ventricle, allowing blood to back up and go another direction. You can have a patent ductus arteriosus. So if that ductus arteriosus does not close after birth, it can remain open and you can have a PDA or patent ductus arteriosus. You can also have an atrioventricular septal defect. This is a defect that sits higher. It encompasses both the atrium and the septum, as far as the defect is up higher or in the middle, more so, of the heart. So these are my left to right shunting lesions. These would be classified as acyanotic lesions. They're lesions that increase pulmonary blood flow. So the push is back to the lungs. So, patent ductus arteriosus, of course, it's failure to close that ductus arteriosus after birth. It remains open. This is a defect that can be present all by itself, or it can be in combination with other defects. So it kind of depends on how it occurs. So again, what we have, blood comes in, right? Comes in right atrium, right ventricle. It's going out the pulmonary to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Then we have blood coming back from the lungs, okay? Left atrium, left ventricle, it's going back out. Oh, wait, I think I'm lazy. I'm greedy. I want more oxygen. So I'm just going to detour through there, a little patent ductus arteriosus. I'm going to detour through there, and I'm going to go try to get me some more oxygen. Okay, that's why it's a left to right shunting lesion. If small, it can be asymptomatic. They might not have any symptoms of this if it's a small lesion. So the symptoms that we see, or the degree of symptoms we see, are going to depend upon the degree of left to right shunting that's occurring. So if it's a big lesion, we're going to have more problems with fatigue, diaphoresis, poor weight gain, poor feeding. They'll have bounding pulses, widened pulse pressure. They'll have a continuous murmur. That's another thing. I'm not going to say which defect has a machinery type murmur. I'm not that good at hearing murmurs and differentiating the type of murmur, being perfectly honest. Nurses that work with that all the time, much better. And they can differentiate between. But just know what they're experiencing depends upon the degree of shunting that they have taking place. And that's basically what I just said. Poor feeding, problems with not gaining weight, etc. So they can have a lot of those problems as a result. Okay, an ASD, an atrial septal defect, again, it's a defect between the atria. It's right here. So we have our normal circulation path, right? Right atria, right ventricle, out to the lungs, comes back. And before it can all go out where it needs to go, look, I've got a little detour here. Some of the blood might just cheat, go back into that right atria, back in that right ventricle, back to the lungs. So it's just hitching a ride. This is also greedy. Again, if it's small, it may be completely asymptomatic. We may not have any symptoms as a result of this. And when you talk to your parents, if your parent says, your parent might tell you, my baby was born with a hole in its heart. That's a hole in its heart. An ASD, a BSD, all of those are defects that parents will call hole in the heart. And then usually when they say that, it's like, okay, was it high? Was it an atrial septal defect? Was it a ventricular septal defect? They're basically similar in appearance and everything. This one also can have a loud murmur, dyspnea, fatigue and poor growth, mild CHF. We haven't talked about that. Failure is a major issue as a result of a lot of these defects. Because again, think about how that pump is working. Pump's working normally, we're pumping blood, we're cheating, we're sending more blood back to the lungs. So that pump might have to work a little bit harder because the blood volume is changing a little bit in regards to pressure gradients, etc. So they can go into mild CHF, just like our little old people have CHF. They're not the only ones, but still. So, if this child is asymptomatic, they're just going to have their follow-up with their cardiologist. So they're going to see a cardiologist ever so often, and he's going to decide their plan of care. If they're having symptoms, so maybe it's a little bit larger defect, if they're having symptoms, we're going to give them diuretics and digoxin as indicated. Okay, when I hear diuretics and dig, and I'm thinking my pediatric population, it tends to make me a little bit nervous or apprehensive. Because you've talked about dig before, yes. You've talked about diuretics like Lasix, which is our potent loop diuretic. You've talked about diuretics before. DIG in particular, because of what it can do, and because we're dealing with babies and children, we're going to be dealing with smaller amounts. So if you are a decimal place off in your medication administration, which is why we harp on that so much, if you're a decimal place off, so you're supposed to be giving 0.3 and instead with your calculation you come out with 3, you can kill a child. You might could kill a big person too, but you'd kill a child easier. So those are ones I'm just a little bit like, wait a second. And those are the drugs that we need to double check with another nurse, our calculation and everything, and make sure everything is right before we administer that medication. That's my little rant. Surgically, if it's a larger defect, they can go in and they can close this defect with sutures. They can actually suture it closed. They can use a prosthetic patch. So that's just like putting a patch on that hole. And a lot of times they'll use a transcatheter device and they'll close it during cardiac cath. I'm not so much in on you knowing the types of how they're going to close it or what they're going to do, but just realize if it's larger, we're going to have to take different measures because we're not going to go in there and close any of these. We're going to be caring for these kids after they have them closed. So that's my caveat to that. We can have a VSD or a ventricular septal defect. That's an opening between the ventricles or a hole down low between the ventricles. Again, you can see where oxygenated and unoxygenated blood can mix in that whole big scheme of things. And we're going to be pushing more blood. It's already got oxygen. It's not going to pick up any more oxygen, but we are increasing the amount of blood that we're sending off to the lungs. So that's why it can have respiratory manifestations as a result. So clinically, they'll have tachypnea, dyspnea, poor growth. CHF is very common with a VSD. Again, small defects. Some of the small defects can close all by themselves. They don't need any intervention, but they will actually close by themselves. Some need surgical correction. So just like we talked about before, with sutures or with a patch or whatever, to close off that defect. The other interesting thing about ASDs is that they're often associated with genetic syndromes. And that there's a higher incidence of ASDs in children that have Down syndrome. So when we think about it, the atrioventricular valves are what? What two heart valves am I talking about when I talk about atrioventricular valves? Tricuspid and mitral. Yes. So those are the two AV valves, tricuspid and mitral. Clinically, Clinically, oh, I skipped ahead, didn't I? Because I said all this, I skipped ahead to atrioventricular septal defect, which is the next one. My bad. And this is the higher up one. This is a, when you have inappropriate development of the endocardial cushion, and then you have abnormalities in the atrial and ventricular septum and the atrioventricular valves, which are mitral and tricuspid. I'm sorry, guys. They'll have a heart murmur, signs and symptoms of CHF. They'll even have some mild cyanosis, even though this is a defect that's sending blood back to the lungs. They'll even have some mild cyanosis, and that cyanosis will increase when they cry. So again, if we're looking at therapeutically what we're going to do with these kids, and I said they do have CHF, the majority of them, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to treat our CHF with DIG, diuretics, and ways to increase or decrease afterload. Nutritionally, we're going to help them out a little bit nutritionally as well. So these kiddos might need NG feedings. And again, repair, they need surgical repair. And they may even need a valve replacement. So they kind of have, and I gave you all that, so that's good. Okay, next up are obstructive or stenotic lesions. These lesions decrease cardiac outflow. So the blood leaving the heart is affected with these lesions. They can have pulmonary stenosis, they can have aortic stenosis, and they can even have coarctation of the aorta. So first one we're going to talk about is pulmonary stenosis. Narrowing of the pulmonary valve or the pulmonary artery, opened with a balloon procedure or with surgery. So we've got a narrowing here, and this is affecting blood comes in, unoxygenated blood comes back in, right atria, right ventricle. It's trying to get out of the heart to go to the lungs, and it's meeting that resistance because there's some stenosis there. So it's having to work a little harder to get out to get where it needs to be. Makes sense? They'll have a different kind of murmur. They'll have a systolic ejection murmur. They'll have right ventricular enlargement. Again, we've kind of got a backup in the system. The blood can't get out. You can see it up here. The blood can't really get out. So that right ventricle will enlarge as a result of that. They will have exercise intolerance. And if this stenosis is very severe, these children will also be cyanotic because the blood can't get out of that right-hand side to go to the lungs to pick up oxygen. So they can have problems as a result. Okay, aortic stenosis. Okay, now we're on the other side. We're on the left-hand side of the heart. Narrowing or stricture of the aortic valve. This is also opened with either a balloon procedure or with surgery, if they can do it. So blood's going right atria, right ventricle to the lungs, comes back from the lungs having picked up its oxygen, left atria, left ventricle. Now we're having a problem on that left-hand side. The blood can't get out to get to the circulation like we would like it to. So what do we see here? We see left ventricular enlargement as a result. Of course, they're going to have a heart murmur. They're going to have exercise intolerance. And with these defects, you can understand why they're having exercise intolerance. All to do with the oxygenation of the blood and the blood in the circulation and what it's doing or not doing. They can also have chest pain. They can have dizziness. Because when this blood comes out and it goes out through this aorta, and it's coming up here, so we've got blood going to the brain, we've got blood going to the upper extremity, we've got blood going to the lower extremity, and this is all being hampered. So our pulses will be faint, they can have hypotension, and they can even have syncope. So they'll start fainting. And the other obstructive disorder is coarctation of the aorta. And this is a narrowing of the aorta, usually at or near the ductus arteriosus. And again, we have blood coming in, going to the lungs, coming out, left atrial, left ventricle, out to get to the circulation. It can go to the upper circulation. You see, it's going to the upper circulation, can go to my head, can go to my upper body, can go to my arms, right? But it's stuck here. So I'm going to have a difficulty with my lower. Right? Make sense? With this defect, they're going to need surgical repair and reconstruction. So if we do their blood pressure, we're going to have an increased blood pressure in the upper extremities as compared to the lower extremities.
No, it's crazy.
Because all that blood's going up, little of it's going down. Makes sense? Lower extremity pulses will be weak or absent. They can have nosebleeds. Again, more blood. They can have headaches. More blood. They can have vertigo. They can have leg pain. Less blood. Because it's not going to the lower circulation.
All of this
happens in utero, usually. That's where it all develops. They're born with it, with whatever. And if you really think about the whole gestational process, I mean, the heart's not fully formed until between weeks 2 and 8. So look around, and it's a miracle we're all here. That's just how I think about it, because it is. So many things, a little glitch somewhere in something, and we might have a problem as a result. So if we're thinking about, we've got all these problems. So medical management, if we have a newborn or an infant that has CHF, we're going to give them, of course, DIG, diuretics. We're also going to give them prostaglandin E1. Remember I said this defect occurs about around where that ductus arteriosus was? So we're going to give them prostaglandin or prostaglandin E1 because we want to keep that ductus arteriosus open, because in utero it was doing the same thing. We were bypassing the lungs and we were sending blood through the circulation. So this is going to help if we can keep that ductus arteriosus open. And we do that by giving these babies prostaglandin E1. And that's going to help us increase perfusion to the lower extremities. Older child, we would have to manage that hypertension and provide corrective interventions as best we could. So if you have a child that they suspect has coarctation of the aorta, what's one thing you're going to have in your plan of care regarding vital signs? Check the upper and lower. So you're going to check their blood pressure in their upper extremity. You're also going to check it in the lower extremity. And I gave you before surgical correction. It's all in your notes. Before surgical correction, you're going to monitor the blood pressure upper and lower. They can have rebound hypertension after surgery. We don't think about it, but CVAs, cerebral vascular accidents, are possible before surgery because, again, we've got secondary hypertension going on in the upper circulation. We've got that blood flow that's going up, so they are a little bit more likely, or they are more likely, to suffering from a CVA. Or they can suffer from a CVA. So we don't, again, often think about that. You don't think about a child having a CVA, but they can. Okay. Here's a little study aid. And if you've already watched your musculoskeletal lecture, then you've met Dr. Weston. She came up with this a while back. And her study aid was acyanotic, which is what she calls an old term. Defects, arcs, and stenosis, they don't have cyanosis. So, of course, VSD, ASD, coarctation, pulmonic stenosis or pulmonary stenosis, aortic stenosis, and even PDA, pretty dang acyanotic. So if it helps you to think about it that way, then you've got that to use to think about it that way. I don't know, some people do better with mnemonics than others, but anyway. Okay, next we have cyanotic lesions with decreased pulmonary blood flow. This is our tetralogy of Fallot. Our tricuspid valve abnormalities. So again, automatically, if I've got decreased pulmonary blood flow, my blood's not going left to right, my blood's going in the opposite direction. So it's going away from my lungs. So tetralogy, tricuspid valves, are valve abnormalities, pulmonary atresia with an intact ventricular septum. These are all those types of lesions. And when we're talking about these lesions that are sending blood away from the lungs, we have to think about the consequences of cyanosis, of this lack of oxygenation. And these are typically referred to as our cyanotic lesions. So we have to think about complications of cyanosis. Anyway, consequences of cyanosis: polycythemia, anemia, clotting abnormalities, hypercyanotic episodes, and CNS injury. All consequences of cyanosis. And I really don't know why I put that in right there, but that's okay. So, first one is tetralogy. Tetralogy of Fallot. Tetralogy means four defects. So with tetralogy, you have a VSD, which we talked about, pulmonary stenosis, which we've talked about. You have right ventricular hypertrophy, and you can see that in here, and you have an overriding aorta. So the aorta is actually out of position and it's overriding where it needs to be. Clinical manifestation. So what are we going to see as a result of this? They'll have a murmur. They'll have cyanosis. They'll have polycythemia. They'll have metabolic acidosis. They'll have failure to thrive. They'll have exercise intolerance. They'll have clubbing of the digits. They'll have severe dyspnea. Sorry, let me just down. They'll have clot formation. They'll have growth retardation. So these are all things that can happen as a result. And the child will have what we call TET spells. And a TET spell is when the child will frequently assume or drop to a squatting position. So they'll be going along swimmingly, everything's fine. There's some response in the body because of the oxygen, etc. So they drop to a squat, which shifts the circulation externally from internally because they're kind of compressed in size. The big thing about a squat, a TET spell, it says signs and symptoms include rapid and deep respirations, irritability, crying, peripheral vasodilation. So peripherally, the vessels dilate, increased systemic venous return, increasing cyanosis, decrease in systolic murmur. The episode often occurs in the morning, and it's usually preceded by crying or feeding or defecation. TET spells are usually self-limiting. They can be very scary when you see them, but it's the body's trying to correct itself, basically, by doing this, by dropping into, or by having a TET spell or dropping into a squat. So the biggest thing we're going to do is calm the child. Calm the infant. So if we're doing something with an infant and the infant experiences a tet spell, we're going to put them in a knee chest position because they're not old enough to do it themselves. So we're going to put them in a knee chest position. We're going to give them oxygen. They'll give them morphine, which kind of helps depress the respiratory center. If your child starts having a lot of tet spells, it indicates a need to repair the defect. So if you have a toddler that's playing, or they're playing in the playroom, and they have a tet spell, you're going to leave them in that position. You're not going to pick them up. You're not going to take them out of that position. If they're in the playroom and there's oxygen available, you can put oxygen on them. But first and foremost, you leave them in that position because that's the body's self-corrective mechanism. Pardon? How long do they normally last? They don't last a very lengthy time at all. And they are they do come out of that position. It's self-limiting as far as that goes. So it's not like a half an hour. They're not going to sit there in a squat for half an hour, a couple of minutes, okay? And then you would do the other things as far as put oxygen on them, et cetera. That's the infants. The child's already in a knee chest position. If they drop to a squat, they're already in a knee chest position, okay? And we just talked about that a little bit, about the tet spells. We don't know why they occur. We know what we do about them. Okay, so our next defect is tricuspid atresia. And you might see some defects that I don't talk about. Tricuspid atresia, failure of the tricuspid valve to develop. So they don't have a tricuspid valve. There's no communication from the right atrium to the right ventricle because that tricuspid valve is missing. They must have an ASV or a patent foramen ovale for this fetus or infant to survive. They have to have it because we don't have the normal process, right atrium, right ventricle. It can't get to the right ventricle because I don't have that valve, or the tricuspid valve is missing. Clinically, or clinical manifestations of this, cyanosis, which is severe within hours of birth. They'll be tachycardic. That little heart's working really hard. They'll be dyspneic. Again, not getting the oxygen that they need. They will have chronic hypoxemia. They'll have CHF. We're affecting our pump. And they'll have failure to thrive. These babies also need prostaglandin E1 to keep that foramen ovale to maintain patent ductus arteriosus until emergency surgery can be performed. So we have to keep that shunt open with prostaglandin. and they'll go in and they'll do an emergency shunt at that point. And then they have a whole three-step surgery that they do. Some of these surgeries are really intense, but they'll do a three-step surgery for these young'uns. Kind of fix it. Next we have cyanotic lesions with increased pulmonary blood flow. Kind of different. This is our truncus arteriosus, which I don't talk about, just so you know. Hypoplastic left heart and transposition of the great arteries or vessels. These are considered mixed defects. The first one we're going to talk about is transposition of the great vessels. The aorta arises from the right ventricle. Okay. The pulmonary artery arises from the left ventricle. So that's backwards. So what happens with this? What is the blood doing with this? Right atria, right ventricle, doesn't go to the lungs, goes back to the circulation. On the other side, blood comes in, left atria, left ventricle, goes back, left atria, left ventricle, goes back. So it's picking up oxygen. The other blood remains unoxygenated unless we have something that's going to give us a connection between the two. So basically, you have two separate circulations. Blood's going like this. Unoxygenated, oxygenated. So we have to get those circulations to mix in some way, or this baby is not going to make it. Oh, gosh, I didn't give you very much on that one. Oh. So survival depends on mixing the circulation pathways, which is the biggest thing, through those fetal structures. We've got to have a foramen ovale. We've got to have that ductus arteriosus. So we have to keep those open and maintained. Clinical manifestations, progressive cyanosis, progressing to hypoxia, which progresses to acidosis. Signs and symptoms of CHF, tachypnea, poor feeding, failure to grow. Again, they need prostaglandin E1. And they'll do some palliative surgical interventions, and then they'll have to go in and do surgical management of this defect. Another one is hypoplastic left heart, and it's basically just what it says. An abnormally small left ventricle is noted at birth. The heart can't supply the oxygen needs of the body because of that small left ventricle. And they'll have to go in and do three different surgeries to aid circulation. And in some instances, they're not able to, and they have to go in and do a heart transplant. So, what are the problems of a heart transplant?
Rejection.
What was you saying? Rejection. That's always an issue with any vessel that's transplanted. Where are we going to get a little heart? From another baby. Do we have a lot of babies out there that we can get a heart from? You cannot put a big person's heart into a baby. It won't work because of the size of the heart. So you'd have to have an infant donor that matched and everything else. So you have a lot of problems or issues in regards to finding a vessel to transplant, a heart to transplant, and then actually transplanting it. So they have a lot of problems. In the, I guess, and there are procedures that they're able to do, and there are things that they can do. Before, when these babies were born, they were given no chance of survival. It's just like, well, they're not going to live. There's nothing we can do about it. So they weren't giving any chance of survival, which is very, very sad. Another little study aid, cyanotic. If it starts with a T, a blue baby, you'll see. So after that, with all the defects, and we talked about so many of these kiddos that wind up with CHD, we have to think about our management of the child that has CHD and what our goals of management are. Okay, so our first goal is to improve oxygenation. So how can we improve oxygenation? What steps can we take? What things can we do to improve oxygenation? Somebody, anybody. What position do you put them in? Can I say it louder? I can hear. I Fowlers, thank you. Or even semi-Fowlers. We want that head up. That's going to help. That provides for optimal lung expansion rather than having them laying down or crunched over or whatever. What about checking our airway patency? Do they need suctioning? If they do, that can help. We have to suction them. We want to monitor our vital signs. I'll probably be throwing these up tonight. Assess airway patency. Position, we said that. Vital signs, we want to do heart and respiratory rates, making sure. Monitor their color and their O2 saturation. Because this helps us guide, or helps doctors guide, everybody guide, how much oxygen we need to administer. By looking at their color, looking at their oxygen sats. We want to observe for signs of respiratory distress. So what would we see if we think they've got respiratory distress? Haven't had that lecture yet, but we'd see tachypnea, right? We see some nasal flaring. We're going to see some retractions. Where they're pulling so hard, we see the tissue sink in between the ribs. So they're retracting. They might grunt. And that will all help. We're going to listen to our lungs. Those are the things I said. We're going to listen to our lungs. We're listening for any adventitious sounds. Do I have any extra sounds? Do I have anything going on? We want to promote adequate nutrition. And my question here says, why? Why do we want to promote adequate nutrition? Because they have an increased energy expenditure due to increased cardiac and respiratory workloads. So that's why their nutritional needs are increased. Their feedings take longer. If we're breastfeeding them, or we're bottle feeding them, the feedings take longer. So if they're on a formula, we're going to give them an increased calorie formula to help meet some of these needs. If mom's breastfeeding, we're going to augment that breast milk. If they're bottle fed, we're going to cross-cut that nipple to decrease energy expenditure so that they don't have to suck as hard to pull that formula. We want to make sure we decrease the time of feeding to no more than 20 minutes. So they take what they take in 20 minutes. And then whatever's remaining, we might just have to drop a tube and gavage that the rest of that formula. So use a feeding tube, drop it down, and put it in there. Set all this. 1 minute. Older children, we're going to give them small, frequent feedings. In some instances, they may need TPN to help supply their nutritional needs. Okay. We want to assist the child and family to cope. Why is this such an issue? If you had a baby with a congenital heart defect, would you be more protective or less protective of this child? More protective. You might even be overprotective of this child, which is possible. If you're overprotective, what about that child achieving their normal developmental milestones? So we have to think about that. It can affect, but they do tend to be overprotective. We want to get them to voice their feelings, their questions, and their concerns. With infants, it's very, very important to encourage attachment and bonding. Sometimes if you have a baby that's born with an issue or a problem, parents are afraid. They're afraid to touch the child. They're afraid to hold the child. They're afraid. And that's understandable. We can see why. So we want to do our best to kind of encourage that attachment and bonding with that mom. The child, we need to provide that child with developmentally appropriate explanations. We want to encourage play therapy to help with their understanding of what's going on. Okay, it's very important we prevent infection. We've already got something going on with the heart. We need to prevent infection. Of course, we remember A number one, hand hygiene. We need to make sure they're getting appropriate dental care. Why is that so important? Why is dental care so important? And where does it go if you get an infection in your mouth? All these lovely mucous membranes up here, where does it go? Bloodstream. Where does the bloodstream go? Goes through the heart. Winds up at the heart. Okay? Preventing infection, hand hygiene, appropriate dental care. All of those are very, very important. Next, we have those acquired cardiovascular defects. They're not born with them. They get them later. Are they acquired in some way, shape, or form? One we've kind of talked about going through is CHF. Okay. So we have to think about some of the things going on with CHF are heart failure. They have an impaired myocardial function. So they'll be tachycardic. They can have a gallop rhythm. They can have pulmonary congestion. So they can have tachypnea, increased work of breathing. They can have retractions and grunting and nasal flaring, dyspnea and wheezing, all those things. They can have systemic venous congestion. So they might have edema. They might have neck vein distension. They might have hepatosplenomegaly. So all those things we kind of have to think about. So our goals of treatment and nursing measures. So first goal of treatment is to improve cardiac function. We do improve cardiac function, and we do that through medications. And we've talked about medications as we've kind of gone through. We've talked about DIG. We haven't talked about ACE inhibitors. We remember what our ACE inhibitors are? There are prills, right? So those are all of our prills. So we have to think about our prills and what we're going to be doing as far as giving those. So if we're using medications, let's see, what have we there? We have to teach these parents the correct way to measure and the correct way to give medications. They don't always know, they don't always remember, so we need to make sure we're teaching them how to do that. Digoxin, our nursing intervention for DIG, we're going to check that apical pulse before we give it, and we're going to withhold it if less than 90 in infants and less than 60 in adolescents. 90 in infants, 60 in adolescents. It would be in your best interest to review DIG. And remember all those things. If you give your child DIG and the child throws up, what do? You give them more? No. What do you think you need to do? You need to get an order for a DIG level? Do they have too much on board? Is that causing it? So think about those. Look at your DIG levels, things like that, how to get it. Our ACE inhibitors, of course, yes, ma'am. Probably, yeah. They got too much. So we remember our ACE inhibitors. Those are our prills. We need to check their blood pressure before and after dosing. Before we give it and after we give it. Okay. We need to look at restoring fluid balance. So we want to remove accumulated fluid and sodium, and we do that with diuretics. Usually the big gun is Lasix. Lasix is a potent loop diuretic. What else does Lasix cause? What with my potassium? Is it potassium sparing or potassium wasting?
Potassium.
Wasting, okay. So we need to think about potassium as well. They can sometimes give aldactone. Aldactone is another diuretic, and they can give that in combination with these other two, one or the other. And aldactone is a potassium sparing diuretic. So we might have to do that. They might be put on fluid and or sodium restriction. It doesn't happen often, but they might be. Goals of treatment and nursing measures: decrease cardiac demands or workload. So we do that. We're going to minimize these metabolic needs by providing a neutral thermal environment. We want our babies and children to be Goldilocks. Not too hot, not too cold. We want them just right. So we want that neutral thermal environment. We want to treat any existing infection that they might have. We want to reduce the effort of breathing. And again, we can think position might be easier for them to breathe if we put them in a more upright position. So think about some of these things. We might need to provide medication for sedation if indicated to help minimize those needs and to help them rest. We want to provide rest and decrease environmental stimuli. So if you have a baby with a cardiac issue, everybody's worried. Talking heart, everybody's worried. It's not something people can see. It's not an obvious defect, but people can't see that. But because it's the heart, everybody's worried, worried, worried. And that's when everybody's going to be trying to visit, et cetera, et cetera. So think about ways to provide rest, decrease environmental stimuli. In the hospital, you might have to put a sign on the door. Because they're not there talking to the child, they're there comforting and talking to the parents. But a lot of that noise is going to keep that child from resting as they should be able to do. We want to improve tissue oxygenation. We think about position again. How are we going to position them? We might have to suction them. We might even have to do CPT as indicated. Okay, so we might have to do chest physiotherapy to help loosen secretions or whatever, if they've got a lot of secretions anyway, to help improve that perfusion. We might have them, and we probably will have them on oxygen. So all that's with CHF. Good. The next up is infective endocarditis. It is just what it says it is. It's an infection of the valves and the inner lining of the heart. It can be by a bacteria. It can be by a virus. It can be by a fungus. Any number of causes. Infective endocarditis occurs most commonly in children in the presence of CHD. So they have some CHD already, or they have CHD, and this can occur basically as a result or as a consequence. To determine if they have infective endocarditis, they will do three separate blood cultures to identify the organism that's causing it. They'll also have on an EKG, they'd have a prolonged PR interval. They'd have cardiomegaly, the heart would be enlarged, anemia, and an elevated SED rate. And those can also help in that diagnosis. Manifestation, so if they do have infective endocarditis, they'll usually have a fever. They'll have those non-specific symptoms that kids always have, the anorexia, the nausea, the fatigue, the malaise, the arthralgias, all of those. You might have a new or changing heart murmur. they might have chest pain, might have heart failure. They might have formation of petechiae. They can even form emboli as a result of this, because it's an infection in the heart and it's affecting circulation, etc. So it depends on what's going on. Management, prevention is most important. We've already said something about oral hygiene and why we need to watch that. Children at risk need good oral hygiene. So if they have an underlying CHD, then in particular, they need good oral hygiene. I think all kids need good oral hygiene, but we don't always see that taking place. They'll also receive antibiotic therapy prophylaxis before any procedure that can introduce organisms into the blood for any child that has a heart condition. And the standard is to give them amoxicillin PO 1 hour before the procedure. Okay. The next one is rheumatic fever or acute rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is an inflammatory disease that affects the heart, the joints, the CNS, and the sub-Q, or the sub-Q tissue. Heart damage is primarily to the mitral valve. Rheumatic fever is related to strep infections. So we think about the manifestations. This is one way to think about it. Arthritis, which is the most common. Carditis, which is the most serious. It's a major cause of morbidity and mortality. Chorea, those involuntary, purposeless, jerky movements. Erythema marginatum, those red, painless skin lesions. And rarely they can develop sub-Q nodules. So the biggest thing with rheumatic fever is to eradicate the strep bacteria that causes it. And so they're going to give them penicillin, they'll give them erythromycin if they're penallergic, just to get rid of the strep. They're going to treat the other symptoms, whichever ones they might be having. They can use anti-inflammatory agents, they can use aspirin, they can use steroids. Note I did say it's okay to use aspirin with rheumatic fever, okay? They can use those two things. Kiddos with rheumatic fever are susceptible to recurrence and require secondary prophylaxis. So, those that don't have cardiac complications as a result of their rheumatic fever, we're going to continue them on secondary prophylaxis for 5 years or until they're 21 to 25 years of age. If they have cardiac complications, I'm sorry, we're going to give them this prophylaxis for 10 years or until they're 40. So when we're giving them their secondary prophylaxis, they can have that prophylactic medication by injection once a month, or they can take it by mouth twice a day. by mouth twice a day is sometimes a little bit harder to ensure with kids and with parents and their schedules, etc. But beware. So that's kind of important. We want to provide emotional support. Prevent further infections. We want to give them information about this chorea and about safety measures we would use. So if they're having these random jerky movements, first thing, realize it doesn't last forever. Okay, that's one good thing. But because they're having them, we're going to have to think about their safety. So we don't want them falling out of the bed. So we might have to put their mattress on the floor. We're probably going to have to help them with stairs. And we're going to have to let them know this is temporary. We're going to get through this. It's temporary. But we do have to think about their safety, because that is super important and something we need to be aware about. And then screening for strep. Again, okay. And this is just like a little, I don't know, picture, if you will. It talks about acute rheumatic fever, valvulitis, pericarditis, myocarditis, erythema marginatum, subcutaneous nodules, arthritis, arthralgias, the synonyms chorea, or it's referred to as St. Vitus's dance, sterile vegetations, all that just kind of puts it in a picture form. Again, Dr. Weston, polyarthritis, erythema marginatum, hers is PECs, carditis, chorea, and again, subcutaneous nodules. And so that's just another little helper, I guess you could say. Well, it is. This is probably next to the last one. Yay. Kawasaki's disease. Sounds like the motorcycle, but it's not.
I know that one.
It's acute systemic vasculitis of unknown cause. We don't know why they get this. This is seen most frequently in children younger than age 5, with a peak incidence between 18 to 24 months. When we're thinking Kawasaki's, the acute phase lasts 10 to 14 days. High fever persists greater than 5 days. That's unresponsive to antibiotics and antipyretics. They have bilateral non-purulent conjunctivitis. They have changes in the mucous membranes. They have fissures, erythema, cracking of the lips, strawberry tongue. Changes in the peripheral extremities, swelling with erythema of the hands and the feet. They have a generalized erythematous rash and enlarged cervical lymph nodes. Acute phase, 10 to 14 days. Look at your age of occurrence. Peak incidence, 18 to 24 months. Okay, high fever doesn't respond or react to antibiotics. Okay, from this we go to the subacute phase from approximately day 15 to day 25. Fever goes away, a lot of the symptoms will resolve. Continued irritability. When I say these kids are irritable, they are irritable. Okay. Anorexia, they don't want to eat. Why don't they want to eat? What's going on with the mucous membranes? What do we have going on with their mouth? Don't you think that would make them sore? Make them not likely or wanting to eat? We had swelling in the hands and feet. Now we have desquamation. So the skin starts peeling off, hands, feet, of fingers and toes. They still have arthritis and they still have arthralgias. And they can have cardiovascular manifestations. They can have CHF. They can have dysrhythmias. A lot of times, more typically, they develop coronary aneurysms. If nothing else, I hope I've painted a picture of a miserable child. If you have a miserable child because they have this and they're so, so sick, what are your parents going to be? Miserable. Everybody. The child's grouchy. The parents are grumpy. Nobody's feeling it. It's not something uncommon. I've seen about 4 cases over time. The first one I saw was in a 3-year-old, and he was miserable. And the parents was miserable. Mom was with him. She tried to switch out with dad. We try to give her little breaks. But, yeah. Convalescent stage begins on day 26. So we're almost at a month, y'all. It's a long time. Continues until the ESR returns to normal and all signs of illness have disappeared. That's a long time. So the management is directed at preventing or reducing coronary artery damage. We already said aneurysms are more common. So we want to prevent them or we want to reduce any damage to the coronary arteries. We're going to give them high dose IVIG. And we're going to give them high dose aspirin therapy, which is going to help lower the incidence of coronary artery abnormalities when given within the first 10 days of illness. IVIG is given in a single dose, 2 grams per kg over 10 to 12 hours in an infusion. Aspirin is given 80 to 100 mg per kg per day in 4 divided doses until fever resolves. Then 3 to 5 mg per kg per day, once daily through week 6 to 8. If they have coronary artery abnormalities, they're going to continue on aspirin indefinitely. So when you think about all this, think about your medication administration. We're giving these kiddos high dose aspirin therapy. Aspirin is an acid, right? Acetylsalicylic acid. We need to give their aspirin with food or milk. We already talked about all the issues they have with their mucous membranes, but we still have to think about hydration of these kiddos. So we might can use popsicles or ice to kind of help numb the mucous membranes. We can give them high calorie liquids through a straw. We wouldn't be giving them citrus or sodas, soft drinks, anything like that, because those are very irritating. Favorite soft, bland foods. We don't want to be doing chips. Again, they're rough. They're salty too. They can hurt like all get out. So favorite soft, bland foods. Comfort measures, calm environment, reassure and support the family. We are going to help them through this. Hopefully. Yeah, you will. And there's a little picture of that. Strawberry tongue, red lips, conjunctival redness, lethargy, irritability, cardiac complications, rash, intermittent colicky pain, red soles and palms, pallor, fingernails and toenails, superficial skin layers, desquamate easily. So again, not a very happy camper. No, I wouldn't be. Lastly, we have hypertension. We are perfect. Primary hypertension occurs in post-pubertal children who are overweight or obese. Primary. Most common cause is secondary, though we are seeing more primary hypertension. As a result of renal disease, cardiovascular disease, neuro disorders, etc. Signs and symptoms of hypertension. Infants and young children will be irritable. They might bang their heads because their heads hurt, so they might bang their heads. They might rub their heads. They might wake up screaming in the night. Older children will complain of headaches and dizziness and vision changes. Management, weight reduction, diet, like sodium restriction, exercise may help them all. All those things can help. Some are going to require antihypertensives or diuretics. So, stop. Let me quit sharing. Oh, wacky. Okay. So, again, as I said at the beginning, think about what's going on with the different defects. What's happening? What's going on? How is the blood moving? Because it's moving this way or that way, what is that going to cause? What kind of problem is that going to cause? And realize there are only 20 questions to cover all of this. Does negatives have any questions? No, they're good? Perfect.
I was just going to say the page numbers for this chapter in our book is 1461
through 1505. Oh, sorry. Page numbers for this chapter in the book, 1461 to 1505. Okay, my bad. We changed to edition. Any questions here? We all cool?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'll talk with Ms.